Whether you're just looking to stay warm during a hunt or need maximum concealment, the clothing you wear can make or break a hunt. At MidwayUSA.com, we understand hunting clothing has come a long way with more meticulously crafted camo patterns, advanced scent control technologies, and weatherproof options to withstand the elements. Hunters have to wait until their favorite season, but shouldn't wait on gear, which is why MidwayUSA offers super fast shipping. When you're ready for your next system, log on to MidwayUSA.com.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Welcome back for another OG Show Live. Mr. Randall, how you doing?
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Reel Down.
Welcome back to another episode of Bass Fishing for News.
Hi, boys and girls. Welcome to, once again, Bass Kayak Adventures.
Brother, this is the final cast.
Another segment of Chasing the Tide, your saltwater connection on the Paladin.
Welcome back, everyone. Another episode of Feather and Fur, your host, Brad.
Welcome back to the Mindset Podcast. I'm your host, Crystal.
Hey, welcome back to Off the Water.
Susie Q here with Adventures of Outdoor Woman Podcast.
Hey guys, welcome to the Rusty Hook Kayak Fishing Podcast.
We're brought to you by Pelican Built Tough. For all situations, go to pelican.com. Eastport Marina on the beautiful shores of Dale Hollow Lake. For all your lodging, kayaking, go to eastport.info. Yak Gadget. For all your fine kayak fishing accessory needs, go to yakgadget.com.
Welcome back, everyone. Another episode of Feather and Fur, your host, Brad Hurlbus. And tonight we have on Aaron Curlin. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brad.
I'm excited for this one. My shows really tend to have a really heavy Midwest field. Now I've done some stuff for down south, Texas, Arkansas, things like that. I've done a couple of episodes out in Oregon, in California, but I'm really excited to get someone on out from out west, and you're from Wyoming then.
I am from Wyoming. I live just outside of Laramie.
Very nice. I've not been to that side of this. I've not been to Wyoming, actually. So I don't think I have. I'm trying to think. Where did I break down coming back from California? That might have been. I'd have to look on a map. I don't remember what route I took. I know I went through Utah. It's possible.
Most likely on 80. What part of California?
I was outside of San Francisco. So I would have came right through Salt Lake City, through Reno. I'm pretty sure I broke down somewhere. Yeah. Like I was just coming down the mountains and the transmission on the Honda Accord I had, an old Accord, just completely went and crapped the bed. And it was for how terrible of an experience it was, because I was moving back. I had my car packed, the dog in a kennel. And I broke down and I called my insurance company. They got a tow truck driver. He's like, can the dog jump up in the cab with us? We went back. And I told him what's going on and I'm trying to get home to Wisconsin. And he's like, I got someone we can call. So he's like, well, first he's like, do you want to load this thing in the bed of a U-Haul? You want to go rent a U-Haul? I'll load it. All you need is a loading dock to get it out. I'm like, I don't even want this car anymore. Like, this thing was just to get me home. I got a car waiting for me at home. That's a good car. This was just supposed to make it one trip. He goes, all right. So we called the local car dealer there, and the car dealer's like, I think he gave me a grand. He's like, I'll give you a grand. And I had some family come and pick me up, so I didn't have to worry about trying to mess with a car or anything. And the tow truck driver, like, it was such an awesome experience from a super small town. He took me to his bank. They gave me cash right away. Like, it was great. Like, for how crappy it was, like, the people there made it good.
Good. That sounds like Wyoming.
I think my favorite part was I woke up in the morning and I went out to went down to the lobby of this hotel. It was a small little hotel. And I look outside and there's antelope in the parking lot. I'm like, I've never even seen an antelope before. And here they are in the parking lot.
Excellent.
I figured that's kind of got to be like deer hunting. You know, you're driving down the road, you see deer everywhere. You go into the woods to go deer hunting and you see nothing. So I kind of took it like with that same grain of salt. Like I'd probably go in the mountains antelope hunting and never see anything while they're hanging out in the parking lot of my hotel.
You know, the antelope here, like everywhere, like driving through, you see them everywhere. Even though, you know, our numbers are down right now, there's just a crazy amount of them. So to drive across Wyoming, I was in New Mexico earlier this year, elk hunting, and I was surprised. I even asked my guide, I'm like, you guys don't have antelope? He's like, oh, no, we do. We hunt them right here on the ranch. And I was pretty floored that there weren't a large quantity of them, because here, if you don't see them, something's usually wrong.
Sure, that makes sense. It's crazy to think about, like, just how much that difference there. Terrain's different and everything. I understand that, but like, you're still in elk country. They're in elk country. Like, you would think it would just be synonymous with each other, and it isn't.
No, it's not. But yeah, that's one thing about our state is, you know, the wildlife opportunities are pretty darn good.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't done a ton of research. I did a little bit when I was sitting there in that hotel room because I had nothing else to do. I'm like, well, if there's antelope just outside here, like, what's it take to hunt one? But I know, like, you have a lot of different species out there, and I know you hunt a lot of different species as well. So what are, like, some of, like... Before we get too far down that rabbit hole, I really do like to get, like, just a little bit of background. So when did you start hunting? Was it a family tradition? Did you take it up on your own? Are you a late onset hunter like myself?
Sorry, you glitched out there.
Broke up a little bit.
Yes, sir.
I know you're in a random hotel with probably limited Wi-Fi. So why don't you just drop video then and see if we can't clean this up so we can at least have some good audio?
Okay.
All right. Can you hear me now?
Sorry about that, Brad.
Oh no, it's all good. Is it a little better now?
It is way better.
Perfect. Yep. We'll just go this route. That's fine. All my listeners on YouTube and on the Facebook can just look at my beautiful face tonight. So as I was getting started to say, I like to get a little bit of background information. I like to know how people got into hunting, because I'm a late onset hunter. My family didn't hunt, but since I've started hunting, I have a lot of traditions. Like, we have a deer camp, we have grouse camp. This was our 13th year of grouse camp, if I remember correctly, 12th year, 13th year. So I'm really curious to, like, always know, like, how people got into the outdoors and hunting.
So I kind of grew up in a hunting home. My dad hunted growing up. One of my earliest memories was walking around behind him, you know, deer hunting up north of Cheyenne. My mom hunted. My grandfather hunted. When I came to legal age, my mom had kind of quit hunting. So, you know, it was, I didn't have, you know, that mentorship there. One of my best friends, his dad just pretty much took me in, took me everywhere. I went rabbit hunting with him, bird hunting, everything from doves and pheasants to, you know, ducks and geese, turkeys. I was really fortunate to have them as an influence in my life to get me going. And then as I got older, you know, it was and started paying, you know, being able to pay for more, I was able to go, you know, elk and deer and antelope hunting and pretty much everything else from there.
So you definitely had some mentorship along the way from not only your family, but friends and family, which is, that's awesome.
Yeah, I'm pretty blessed to have grown up the way that I did, although my wife might argue that it's a bit expensive at times.
Yeah, when you look at it price per pound, there's no way hunting's cheaper than just going and buying half a cow. That's for sure.
Exactly. But the memories that are made are part of that, I think, part of that equation as well.
Agreed, 100%. It's, for me, it's all about the experience. I mean, that's a huge part to me. I don't need to take an animal in order to have a successful hunt.
Exactly. You know, that's in my mid 20s, I got into lion hunting, and I discovered there that, you know, running them with hounds, that I can have just as much fun leaving that animal in the tree and just taking some pictures and video and walking away than I do, you know, when one's harvested.
Now that is something I have never talked to anybody about. So I want, like, I definitely want to talk about that. Like, I have a good friend of mine. We hunt bears with hounds in Wisconsin. There's really two ways to do it. It's either with hounds or with bait. And a good friend of mine, and I've had many conversations with him about running hounds for bears. So I'm really curious to know, like, what you're doing out west for lions.
It's kind of similar to your guys' bear hunting. Except, you know, here we'll drive around and mostly look for a track. I'm a little different than most of the guys that I know hunting them. I'll drive around in the morning, look for a track. And if midday I haven't found anything, I'll take the dogs and just free cast them into a canyon. And if we get to run something, we get to run something. If not, the dogs get out and get some exercise. And, you know, I'm able to make a little bit, I think, a little bit better dog that way, because they get used to handling in a hunting scenario without the same pressure as, you know, when you're on a lion track, or, you know, when you're just collaring up and dumping straight out of the box. So, I think it makes a little bit better dog that way. But, once we find a track, generally we collar the dogs, and depending on the track, I usually put my lead dog down first and let them take it. And then I go on foot behind the dogs every time after that. So it doesn't matter whether it's, you know, 300 yards from the road or 6 miles from the road, I'm following them the whole way.
Got it. So you're putting a lot, you're not driving around chasing them with trucks. You're putting a lot of time in on the ground with boots.
I do both. Okay. Like I said, so I'll leave the house at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'll run roads until 10, 11 o'clock in the morning. And if I don't have something, I'll make it a point to be to a familiar canyon where I've had success in the past. And I'll walk up the canyon and until I feel like I'm tired. And if we have a track, then we go from there. If we don't, then, you know, I go back, take the dogs back to the truck and go and try again the next day.
Right. And I didn't specify. I know a lot of guys that run bear hounds. They'll let the hounds go, and then they'll follow them in UTVs and trucks. They're not chasing them on foot until they've got a bear treed, basically. And then they're going in by foot. Whereas it sounds like when you let the dogs down, you're on the ground with them.
Yeah. And I guess the main reason for that is where I hunt, in the time of year I hunt, a lot of the roads are shut down anyway.
Got it.
So there's a lot of times there's no way to get closer to them anyhow, but I also run a lot of puppies. So, like right now I'm starting two new pups and I have to follow them in order to keep up, you know, make sure that they're keeping up and staying on the track.
Sure. That makes sense. You're always also, I mean, every time you throw the dogs on the ground, I mean, it's no different than duck hunting or like waterfowl hunting or meet with my versatile dog or grouse hunting. It's always training as well. Like you're hunting, but there's always training in the background.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. If, you know, they get to a point where, you know, where you think that they're too good for training, then it's probably time to start some new ones anyway.
Sure. How many dogs are you running on average then?
Right now I have, I have 7 hounds, I guess. I've got 6 dogs that are running age right now, and then an 8-week old puppy.
Okay. And then, go ahead.
Oh, and you know, I kind of constantly rotate them in. I'm probably too much of a perfectionist. I've got my 4 core dogs that probably won't ever go anywhere, but I, you know, I'm always trying to complement those dogs. So I'm, you know, if I get a dog that's good and started and he's just not quite what I, you know, keeping up with the others or running middle of the road, then, you know, I'll sell him to, you know, I just sold one this spring to a good friend of mine so he could start some puppies with him. And I helping him out and helping me out on making room for hopefully my next rock star.
Sure. That makes sense. You run them all at the same time. You throw in all seven on the ground at the same time, or you kind of rotate them in? You have like four one day, three the other day, kind of rotate them, or can your dogs pretty much run every day back to back to back?
So it depends on the time. You know, if I've got females cycling, then I just take the females. If I've got a track that I, you know, that crosses my pickup tracks within a short amount of time, then I'll just put puppies down or young dogs down on it and leave the better dogs back. If, you know, if I don't know how fresh the track is for certain, then I'll just put them all down and let them trail. It, you know, in my opinion, doesn't do any good to hold my dogs back if they've got the opportunity to chase. And you know, it the more experience that you can get a dog, the better they're going to be. And it doesn't matter whether it's bird hunting or hunting lions or shed hunting.
Agreed, 100%. I mean, we always, I always jokingly say it to new trainers and whatnot, but it's pretty serious. I always say wild birds make a bird dog. I mean, birds make the bird dog. And I'm sure that's real similar when it comes to running hounds as well. I mean, it's the tracking, it's the trailing, it's all of that. And those more experiences and the more opportunities to get, the better they're going to get to hone their own skills.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, when you start any dog, you know, that first few times that they're out doesn't necessarily have any indication on how they're going to turn out in the long run. And the more experience that you can give them, you know, it seems like the better odds are that they're going to turn out the way you want anyhow.
Makes sense. Makes a lot of sense. So is that where you probably, I mean, I know you're out west, you have lots of opportunities. Is that your main passion then? Is the main passion running the dogs?
Midway USA brand product designers have one straightforward goal: develop high quality, technically sound products and deliver them to customers at reasonable prices. If you are immersed in the shooting sports industry and pay close attention to every single detail, you know our products are built right and stand up to everyday use. Who has shooting mats and range bag systems to hunting clothing and just about everything for the outdoors? Log on and shop 24/7 with super fast shipping. MidwayUSA.com. At Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com.
Did I lose you there, Aaron?
Nope.
Oh, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Things. Oh, okay. Yeah, I can hear you now. For whatever reason, it was glitching.
That's all right. That happens. No big deals. I asked it. I know out west you have a lot of opportunities, and we're going to get into more of them, but is running the dogs on lions really your main passion? Like, when you wake up in the morning and you have a choice of what to do, is it going to be grab the dogs?
Absolutely. If I could hunt them year round, reasonably successfully, I would dang sure do it. But I also hunt, big game. I really enjoy hunting elk. I guide, usually a couple weeks out of the year, I guide some elk hunters, primarily archery. I hunt antelope almost every year. I didn't this year. And then I hunt deer every year. And I really, really like to hunt big deer. It just seems like I've been having a heck of a time finding those big deer in recent years.
So for deer out there, I don't want to make any assumptions, but I'm going to assume you got mule deer out there, or do you also have whitetail?
We have mule deer and whitetail out here.
Okay.
Our I think our biggest draw is the mule deer, just because, you know, most eastern states, in fact, east of Nebraska, it's pretty hard to find a mule deer. So I think that's our biggest draw. And I truly enjoy hunting mule deer more so than whitetails, although I will hunt whitetails. We have some opportunities where we can hunt. If I put in for a special tag, I can hunt whitetails and then get a general tag and hunt mule deer in the same year. So I'll do that occasionally.
All right. So there is a mixed opportunity out there for that. Is it, do you have about an equal population, or is it more mule deer out there, or is it more whitetail out there?
I'd say it's probably more mule deer, but our whitetail population is really booming, and I think that's why there's so many opportunities for them right now. We do have some areas where you can go up and dang near shoot a whitetail every day of the season, but for the most part, most of the state, it's, you know, you get one or two opportunities a year.
Got it. I'm surprised. I knew the whitetail range was big. I know it's a very vast range, but I think out west, I always think mule deer, and maybe that's because I come from a state that's whitetail only. They have reintroduced the elk here. We have a very, very limited hunting opportunity. There's 10 tags they have released a year, which is a lottery. So pretty much good luck, right? Like if you want to go shoot an elk, I would. Yeah. If I want to shoot an elk in my lifetime, I'm not going to count on doing it in my home state of Wisconsin. That's for sure. But I think out west, I think like Wyoming and Montana, I always just think, I know they have whitetail, but my mind instantly is just drawn to mule deer. It's just interesting how that works. How, like, you associate, maybe it's because I don't have it, but I just associate it with mule deer, not thinking that there's a large whitetail opportunity out there as well.
Yeah, and I think that's a fair assumption. We do have, I would say we have far more mule deer than whitetail, but there's some phenomenal spots to hunt whitetail here where you stand a pretty good chance at a 150-inch whitetail or maybe a little bit better. I think the biggest that I've killed is about 130 inches, but there's dang sure bigger here. And, you know, where the mule deer, you have a very, very reasonable chance at shooting a 170-inch or better buck if a guy wants to be patient in some areas. The past, 3 years, I haven't killed a mule deer because I just haven't seen anything mature enough for me.
Got it. Those,
not that I'm a snob. It's just, you know, I'd hate to shoot a young deer, and when I can pass on him and hopefully, you know, and in 3 or 4 years be something spectacular.
Sure. No, I completely understand that side of it. Get that 100%. And then with your other opportunities for elk and other things, it's not like you're, it's like for me, like when the season starts to draw on, I mean, it really depends on the year. Like last year I shot the first deer I saw because, well, I really wasn't in, like, I wanted the meat in the freezer. My goal was to fill my freezer and I wanted to get back out with my dog is really what I wanted to do last year. We'll see what mentality I have this year, because I might have the same mentality of the first big doe I see. I'll put that down. I'll put meat in my freezer and I'll get right back out with my dog. But I do have a couple of nice bucks on my trail camera, which make me think maybe I should be patient this year. But we'll see what happens when I get in the woods.
it's all dependent on which addiction you want to feed at the time, I suppose. Whether it's birds or fur.
Pretty much. I mean, that's a good way to put it. And the problem is, like, I start to feel like the only year I really got into archery hunting was the year my lab at the time hurt his paw and I couldn't run him. Like, otherwise, I sit up in that tree stand and it's a halfway decent day and I'm like, I could be running the dog. What am I doing here? I feel guilty. Like, my dog's at home.
I can empathize with that. I don't sit a tree stand well. I don't sit still well. In fact, if you ever see me in a tree stand for a long period of time, you'd probably think that I was going out of my mind, because You know, our hunting here is a lot of spot and stock and getting out. Now, goose hunting, I can sit in the blind there as long as there's action going on. If not, then I just get bored and I can't do it. I guess maybe I have ADD.
I think that's part. You're onto something there, because I don't find the same relaxation. Like grouse hunting, woodcock hunting, running my dog, walking through the woods. Like, to me, that's relaxing. Like, and not even just relaxing. It's the fact I can focus my attention 100% in the moment, and I'm not thinking about stuff I have to do at home. I'm not thinking about stuff I still have to do for work. I'm focused in the moment. Whereas when I sit up in that tree stand, it's like I look at the same trees for the first hour, and then it's like, now what do I think about? Then my mind drifts to, I really could be doing this, or man, I got all this left to do at work. I'm like, oh, I completely forgot to do that at work. And then it's like, I almost get anxiety, because it's like, I'm thinking about all the things I should be doing when I'm not. Whereas I could see with the spot and stalk style hunt, you wouldn't get that, because you would be in the moment, because you're either moving or you're glassing a different area. And it's not just sitting in that same spot waiting on an animal. It's more you pursuing the animal.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, when I bear hunted over baits, I just get so antsy, you know, I almost can't hardly stand sitting there for any amount of time. And maybe that's probably why I've never been real successful sitting in the tree stand or sitting over bait. I don't know. I'm of the same opinion. If, you know, like elk season this year, I took my dogs out and I ran them mid season, and we ran a cat. It just didn't pan out on the dirt like one would want, but the dogs got out, they got exercise. I got some exercise. It was a good time, and I didn't have to, you know, I didn't have to see the game to have a good time doing it. So kind of the same thing as running your dog. I just enjoy that. And I don't get caught in my own head following them around. And I was fortunate enough this year to harvest a moose. I drew a once in a lifetime Shiras tag here in Wyoming, and I was able to harvest him the second day of archery season. So I don't need the meat this year like what I do typically. So that was handy.
I didn't even know moose hunting was an opportunity out by you. I'm assuming that's resident only. And you said it's a once in a lifetime opportunity. So it's gotta be pretty slim pickings for tags then.
It is. They do have non-residents, resident tags. It's preference based or preference point based. So when you put in there are some random areas. You have to do your research to see what your odds are going to be in those random areas anyway. But then preference points, what I did is I've put in for so many years now that I started looking to see which areas I could draw. Found an area that I should have probably drawn last year. And there were just a couple of people ahead of me that dumped some points into them. So put in for the same area this year and I drew it, started doing research and, you know, contacting people over there and trying to figure out, you know, exactly where the moose were, and opening day of archery season. And I made a couple of trips over there scouting, but, opening day of archery season, I spotted this bull, and on the second day I was able to arrow him and took him home.
That's crazy.
And they're the game and fish here, you know, after attending some meetings and stuff, they did say that for the most part, and especially in the more southern areas, the moose population's expanding pretty well. So we do have some opportunities.
Interesting. And what did that animal dress at? Like, what type of weight are we talking?
I have no idea. It was big. It was,
I know they're big.
You know, I'm not a little guy. And when I rolled him over to try to get a picture of him, it was all I could do. And then he flopped over and I gave up and waited for a buddy to get there to help me take a picture.
And then did you pack that out?
Fortunately we were on a river bottom where we could get almost right to it, and it wasn't much of a pack.
Well, I mean, I can't imagine the number of trips it would take if you were up in the mountains to pack that thing out.
Boy, I'm telling you, one front quarter, it is basically the equivalent of a hind quarter of an elk. It's heavy, and maybe even more than a hind quarter of an elk. And we took, I literally took every edible piece of meat on that moose. And, you know, like I said, fortunately, it wasn't very far to go. It was just, it was heavy and a lot of work. They got there about 9 o'clock, to help me quarter and after pictures and everything. And, we finished up about 1 o'clock in the morning.
Wow. That's a long day. Cause I'm sure you were up.
So, they're a big critter.
That's gotta be a real long day. Cause I'm assuming you were up before sunrise to get where you wanted to be. And then you were still packing, and then you weren't done till 1 a.m.
Yeah. It was a very long day.
That's nuts. That's crazy.
But, you know, guiding the elk hunters, it's not much different. You know, get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, go and hunt, come back, take care of what you can around camp, go back and hunt. And if they harvest in the dark, you know, you're looking at an 18 to 20 hour day sometimes. So it's, you kind of get used to it.
So you sleep when the season's over.
It seems like the season never ends. So I'll catch some sleep someday.
That's awesome. And then for like the elk hunting side of it, when you're guiding, do the clients help pack out their own meat, or is it the guides packing out most of it for them then?
I basically do all the work for them. I figured that it's their vacation. That's what they pay me for. So, I do have some guys that help skin and quarter or gut them, but for the most part, I do the work for them. I don't hold any grudge about that. I feel like that's my duty. But you know, you do get a few guys that want to help. I mean, they almost feel obligated to. And, most of the guys that I'm guiding now are return clientele. So I know before the animal ever hits the ground on whether I'm going to be, you know, doing all the work myself or they're going to want to help or what's going on there. So it's kind of nice.
That is nice. At least you have and it just builds that relationship with that client as well. But for me, if I was to come out there and hire a guide, I feel like I'd have to help pack that animal out. Otherwise, when I came back to Wisconsin, everybody would be like, how was it packing it out? And I just said, what do I lie and be like, oh, it's fine. Like, it wasn't a big deal. I didn't do it. Like, I'd have to take part. Like, I'd have to be part of that grind in order to come back, like, and talk to my buddies and be like, I'll tell you this, man, a hind quarter, 1,000 foot of elevation up that was miserable.
Well, you know, and some guys, I mean, that's exactly how they feel. Most of them will have them pack the head and cape. And, you know, that's a lot of weight in and of itself. But if they're able to pack it.
Sure.
Some guys, you know, they just aren't able to do it. And that's absolutely fine, too.
Right. And that's why they're using a guide. That's why they're not out there do-it-yourself stuff. Can you do it yourself in Wyoming, or do you need a guide in Wyoming if you're a non-resident?
The 1911 is one of the most iconic firearms in history. Designed by John Browning, the 1911 was the standard issue sidearm of the U.S. military from 1911 to 1985. While Colt produced the original, almost every major firearm company has produced its own version. It's wildly revered for its reliability, crisp trigger, and is still a favorite for all types of shooters. Whether you're looking to buy or build a 1911 and just about everything for guns, log on to MidwayUSA.com. Hunting boots are a critical component of any successful hunt. Whether walking a short distance to your blind or trudging miles through rugged terrain, your feet are carrying the load. Without the right boots, you could give up early and lose out on that trophy just over the ridge. At Midway USA, we make selecting boots for your next hunt easier. With just a few clicks of a mouse, you can decide on what's important, like waterproofing, insulation, size, width, and savings. For just about everything for shooting, hunting, and the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com.
What was that, Brad? I'm sorry.
That's all right. Do you need a guide in Wyoming if you're a non-resident, or can you do it yourself out there?
No, there's plenty of guys that come out. They do it themselves. The only place that you're required to have a guide or a resident companion is in the wilderness areas. So, okay. And not all of the forest is wilderness. The big deal is researching where you're going to have your best options of drawing. So like a general license right now, in order to draw one of those is 5 points, I think. So you're looking at in general, waiting 5 years in between a draw, unless you catch a random or something like that for a non-resident.
Got it. I knew I was reading somewhere out there that you needed a resident or a guide. I can't remember if that was if it was Wyoming or a different state. Cause at one point, a couple years back, before I really started to focus and dive in just to bird hunting, I really wanted to get out west for an elk hunt. And I still do, cause I haven't taken an elk. It's definitely on my bucket list. I just remember like reading somewhere, like one of the states out there, like it, you needed a guide or a resident. And maybe I was looking into like the wilderness areas by you then.
Yep. Yeah, that's probably it. And any of the wilderness, a non-resident can't just go in. And I know it drives a lot of guys nuts because, you know, it is public ground. And I'm not sure why Wyoming does that. I mean, a non-resident can come in and they can go hiking and fishing and do whatever they want in a wilderness, except for being there during hunting season hunting. As a resident, I kind of love it. I concentrate for my personal hunting in the wilderness areas because there's less chances of running into somebody there.
Sure. That makes sense. I always thought it would be like a safety factor, but now the fact you say that you can go out there and hike in there, it makes me think like, well, I know experienced hikers, don't get me wrong. I know hunters that aren't that experienced and that shouldn't be traveling in a wilderness area also, but for a generalization, I would think hunters would probably be better bushcraft, people with better bushcraft than random hikers getting out of a car.
Yeah. And you would think that, and maybe it is to alleviate some of the pressure for, you know, for the residents. I have no idea what their theory is on it. But I like it. I mean, just me being, you know, a little bit selfish, I do enjoy it.
I would too. If I lived out that way, I would absolutely utilize that to my advantage, because anybody that's in there is going to be either with a resident or a guide. And at least they're going to understand the culture out there and understand like how hunters treat other hunters out there, with like certain times in Wisconsin for like the opening of our gun deer season, our public land is crazy. Like a lot of our public land is just out of control and people set up on top of people, and it's very unsportsmanlike at time. And I understand it's all public land and everybody has the same rights, but as a public land hunter for a lot of things, especially during like grouse season, if I see a truck parked where I'm thinking about going and it's a bow hunter, I'll go somewhere else, because I'm not going to ruin that bow hunter's hunt. I have other options. He's set up. He's in a tree. Like, he can't just get up and move. I can go somewhere else with my dog. So I show a lot of respect to other hunters that have beat me to a spot on public land. And a lot of that, I just like, it drives me crazy during our gun deer season, just how close people get to each other and just the respect that it just seems like it isn't there. So I can understand coming from like, if I was a resident of Wyoming, like liking the fact that an out-of-state person in those areas has to have a guide or a resident with them, because at least they're going to be understand like the general respect in that area.
I agree wholeheartedly. That's why I go where I do, is you just don't see very many people. And you know, unfortunately growing up and living here, you see more and more of it where guys will pull right in on top of the other, you know, you pull into a one section, you know, a mile by mile section of ground, park in the one parking place, and when you get back to the truck, you know, there's four people coming in right on top of you, or even when you're walking in, there's just not, I don't know that there's a whole lot of guys that have that same respect of seeing another vehicle and going the other way, and I for one am one of those. I just don't like to hunt right on top of people. I want them to have the same opportunity that I've got, so I'll go a different direction. And even with the lion hunting, if I cut a cut a track and I drive around the hill and there's a truck parked on that track, legally I could turn loose on the short end of it, but if they're parked there before me, I'm just going to go on to someplace else and hopefully find another one.
And that's really the same way I am as well. It's the only time in recent history I can think that I've even walked in anywhere close to someone was there's this little great little area I have for woodcock, and like part of the very, very edge nowhere near me is flooded. And there's some duck hunters way over there, and they're like probably 400 yards away from me. And I'm like, that's fine. Like, but if it had been a bow hunter in there, I would have walked away. But I knew they were at least duck hunting. I'm like, we're not going to ruin your duck hunt by any means.
Well, I think that that's the right thing to do, though. And I think bird hunting's a little different, you know, where we have our pheasant populations, there's, you know, large walking areas and, excuse me. And, you know, you don't have anywhere else to park, but if you see somebody going one way, I'll go the other and just try to give that distance instead of being, you know, just right on top of them.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's crazy. Like, and you see it like, I don't even want to say it's not even an age thing. It's not even a generational thing. Cause I've had like duck hunting. I've had old guys set up, like not trying to be mean when I say old guys, but I've had older gentlemen set up right like 50 yards downwind of me. And I'm like, what are you doing? Like, this is crazy. And I've had younger hunters give me tons of space. So it's not even generational. I mean, I don't even know. I don't get it. Like, it's one thing I've struggled with, and I know like the internet makes it even worse with social media, but like the lack of respect, and it just blows my mind. And I get it. I can make the argument all day long as devil's advocate. It's all public water. Like, it's all public hunting land. I get that 100%. But let's be respectful to your fellow hunter. Like, they woke up earlier. They beat you here. There, go to a different spot. Like, if you're like,
absolutely. And I think you hit the nail on the head that, you know, even though we're currently on a social media platform, social media has made things a competition instead of an enjoyment type of thing. And, you know, hopefully we can somehow figure out how to change that competition mentality into just going back and enjoying what we do.
And I think that comes down to what we talked about earlier, where you can take a picture of a line in the tree and have just as much excitement as for dragging the animal. And just like me, I mean, I can watch my dog have a gorgeous point on a grouse and never once even decide to lift my gun because I'm like, it's not a good shot or whatever. And to me, that is just as good of a hunt as if I have a bird in my game bag, or watching mallards dump into my spread and I never get a shot opportunity for whatever reason happens or whatever, or I miss all three shots because I just can't shoot that day. Cause that happens more than I'd like to admit. It still makes an amazing hunt.
I think it happens to everybody. my wife gets upset with me because I'll, you know, there's just days where I don't want to video and I don't want to record. It's just, you know, it's a day for the dogs is what I'll tell her. And, you know, you just have to have that sometimes where you just unplug from it.
Absolutely. And as much as I think about it, I'm like, I need to get like good photos for Instagram and stuff like that. And I want to share my experiences, but then I start hunting and I completely forget about all of it. And all I do is focus on the dog and the birds or what I'm doing. And then afterwards I'm like, I didn't take a single picture. I didn't record a single thing of this other than like the experience with like the memory of it, which I'm okay with.
Yeah. Well, or, you know, you drop your cell phone on the mountain. That's happened. And by time I got the tree, I didn't have anything to video with or anything else. So
did you find your phone?
I'll be honest with you, Brad. I wasn't going back there to get it. we turned loose at daylight. We wound up over the top of the mountain, and by the time we got there, the good friend that he actually got me into the hounds, his legs were cramping up and I couldn't feel my feet. We called in reinforcements and they picked us up on a road and got us back around the mountain. By the time it was all said and done, my feet were frostbit, and and I was early hypothermic, so it was a long day. I didn't go for my phone.
I wouldn't at that point. Like, I got to look at the misery factor versus how much I make an hour, and I make enough an hour to not have to pay to go through that misery again.
Well, the lady at Verizon asked me, she says, well, do you want me to ping your phone? I said, no, ma'am, it's going to stay there.
That's hilarious. I have done that once. I was dragging out a deer and I dropped my phone. And while I finished dragging it out, my buddy went back and he was able to follow our tracks back, and he actually found my phone. Which I couldn't believe it, but I've done it before. I dropped my phone out of my pocket when I was dragging out a deer, and I'm like, I'm never finding that again.
this was one of them. We just topped a ridge and we had a little bit of cell phone service there. So I think I texted my wife and let her know, you know, we're still on the track and everything's fine. And we get down the ridge and up the next one, and I reached to my pocket and it was gone. So I have an idea of where it was, and I'm sure some other hunters picked it up by now.
No one turned it in, though. No one got it back to you. It might still be sitting there.
No, you know? And it very well could be. It's a pretty secluded place, and yeah. I'm good with it staying there. It could be a monument as far as I'm concerned.
You'll cut a track by there in a couple of years, and you'll be like, I wonder if it's still here.
Well, I'll promise you, that's one of those places that I don't necessarily want to go again. It was rough.
Got it. So it'd have to be a really fresh track in order for you to turn the dogs loose in that area again.
I take that. I would. I wouldn't be able to turn one down. But yeah. it's one of those places that's just really rough and rugged and nasty. And I don't know, I think we put on 14 miles probably that day, and it just was all up and down.
That's a lot of miles. And what type of elevation are you talking, when you guys are out there running the hounds and doing that, what type of elevation are you working in?
So I live right now, where I live is about 8,400 feet.
Okay.
Typically where we're hunting lions is right around the same elevation. We'll get up 10,000 feet for elk and deer at times, but for the most part, we do most of our work down on the, or our hunting down on the foothills. So it's not very often that I'm running a lion at, you know, 10,000. We've been to 9,000 or 9,400, but not very often.
Got it. So you're more that 8,500. But I mean, coming from Wisconsin, that's crazy. Cause I mean, right now I just looked, cause I was curious, 907 feet.
Yeah. And it's a big difference. When somebody comes out to elevation to hunt, they have to prepare for that possibility of elevation sickness and, you know, drinking a lot of water. That's going to be your best friend when you come out.
Yeah, I know. Like, and that was one thing. Like, eventually I do want to make it out there, and I really want to get my elk. But that's one thing. It's like, I'm going to have to prepare for terrain that I've never been in. Like, I do a lot of upland hunting. Like, I'm used to working on different terrains and stuff like that, and I have relatively sure footing, but I've never tried to do that in thousands of foot of elevation with different oxygen and everything like that.
Yeah, it's a big change. You know, and I having that background of the upland game, and you know, going from marshes to wheat fields and corn stubble, it's definitely different, because you're going from, you know, the potential to being in the marshes and bogs to, you know, rocky steep faces, and but it's extremely fun. If a guy likes turkey hunting, elk hunting is during the rut is the deal. It's bigger, it's louder, and they can cover a lot more ground a lot quicker.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
I never thought of comparing the two, but I completely understand that now.
Oh, it's similar. You know, you get it. Yeah, you get a, you know, you get a Tom Gobbler gobbling at you. It's the equivalent of an elk. I mean, they're basically just marking their territory, marking their harem, and you know, you get them excited enough to come in and check you out. It's pretty cool that you can, you know, occasionally trick one into coming within bow range. It's there's nothing like it.
Yeah, I always think like I never thought of, I mean, because I know people call elk and everything else, but like that's one of my favorite things about like waterfowl hunting is like calling at the birds, having them react and having them come to me. Like that's one of my favorite things about it is like because you're actively taking part in the hunt. Like you're a key to the hunt's success at that point. It's not so much your stalking ability. I mean, there's more to it because you're actually trying to communicate with this animal and bring it to you. I never thought about that for elk. That has me even more intrigued now.
Oh, absolutely. I highly recommend coming west for the rut hunt, whether it's a muzzleloader tag or you know, or the archery season. You know, Wyoming's just got the archery season for the rut. Okay. Colorado has some muzzleloader stuff and archery all during the rut. There's nothing like it. And when you get into the elk and they're screaming all around you, it's phenomenal.
What type of ranges are you? I mean, I know people say when you go out west, prepare for long ranges with archery. So what type of ranges are you're looking at where you, like for me, if I was going to start like, all right, it's time to start like practicing, like to really practice for the next, like the entire summer, like it's springtime. I've got a tag that I drew, waited my 5 years or whatever it is to get in a unit out there. What type of ranges should I be looking to practice for?
Well, I'll tell you, I grew up shooting a compound and, you know, we shot a lot of tournaments and stuff. 40 yards then was about as far as I'd shoot. About 10 years ago, I went, maybe 9 years ago, I went to longbow or recurve only for, I don't know, 7-8 years. I've been able to kill elk at, well, I've killed three bulls with longbow or the recurve. One at 10 yards, one at 12 yards, and one at 17 yards.
That's awesome.
So, I mean, you can have them right in on top of you. It's good to be able to ethically shoot to 60.
Okay.
You know, a lot of times you get them hung up out there, and depending on you know, where your collar's set up at any time, it's tough to not, you know, just have that extra 20 yards past the 40. But I try to call everything in as close as I can before, you know, somebody gets a shot.
Sure.
And I try to shoot everything of mine close.
Makes sense. No, absolutely makes sense. And I get that. I mean, if your average shot is 40, like that's what you use, like 40, but you want that extra 20 yards just in case, because I pull that tag, I'm only out there for at best a week. I don't have an entire season to chase them. And if it's a bull that it's like, all right, that thing trips my trigger and it hangs up at 60. It'd be a shame if you didn't practice to 60 or 80 at that point. So you felt comfortable at 60 that you had to like walk away.
Exactly.
From that.
Yeah. If you're going to want to ethically shoot to 60, you should be shooting 80 and 100 pretty regularly. You know, the furthest animal that I've ever harvested was my moose, and I shot him at 61 yards.
With
a rifle. Yeah. That's a different story.
Right. Rifle's completely different. I know this is a controversial topic here, but what about crossbows out in Wyoming? Legal, not legal, disabled only?
They are legal.
All right.
And as a guide, I like them. You know, it doesn't require a lot of movement for your hunter to get into position. If they've got a tripod, I've got a guy that actually I pack his tripod for him. And if he listens to this, he's going to laugh about that. It's heavy, but, he sets it up, he can put his crossbow in it, lock it into position, and he doesn't have to be just holding the weight the whole time. Elk comes in and he can make adjustments from there and not have the big movements of swinging a bow up or drawing back. And especially for somebody that doesn't have the time to practice, that 40-yard shot with a crossbow, the way they're built now, is quick. Now, as far as the controversy goes, I don't personally believe it's a bow, but it's legal. And as long as it's legal and ethical, I'm good with it.
That's pretty much where I stand. You already got this for me. Like, I'm a bird hunter first. Like, I'm not an archery hunter. I still have my compound bow, but I did buy a crossbow because I don't have the time throughout the summer between dog training and everything else that I do to be able to, because I live in a subdivision. I live outside of a city. I can't practice I've 9 yards in my basement. That's it. Like, and for me to go to the closest place to shoot, it's an hour and a half of my day. It's a half hour drive each way. And I'm going to spend at least a half hour there, right? If not longer. So I actually made the switch to a crossbow because I can go out and practice just a couple of times. I shoot rifles and other things. So I can make sure it's still true, still tuned in. So if I want to go archery hunting, I feel like I can take an ethical shot to 30 or 40 yards, still realizing that it's still a bow. Like, I hunt woods. Like, it's got to be a clean shot. It's not a rifle. Like, I think about all of that, but it's more ethical for me because I'm actually practiced with it. I don't have the muscle mass or the way to hold back like I used to be able to do with a compound bow when I could shoot outside my backyard every night.
Absolutely. And you're still having to utilize proper shot placement. It doesn't carry the same kinetic energy as a rifle. If you hit one in the shoulder, most likely you're going to lose it. If you hit one far back or high, your chances of losing it are high. So you're still having to be just as pinpoint with your shot placement as you are with a compound or a recurve or a longbow. There is a difference between that and a firearm for sure.
100%. No question about it, because you don't get that high, you don't get that shock and all that other things. And every time I pick that up, I take the same mentality I took with when I was hunting with a compound bow. It had to be a clean shot. I have a decent shooting fast crossbow. I know it can go way farther, but I always practice with my compound, and I felt comfortable. Maximum shot in perfect conditions for me would have been about 40 yards. Because that's all I really practiced to in the woods I hunted. I didn't need more than that. And I've kept that same mentality with my crossbow when I do get the time to go out and use that, just because it is still a bow. It's a bolt, not an arrow. I understand that, but it's still a broadhead on a shaft. It's not a rifle. It's not a shotgun.
I agree wholeheartedly. And I'm not, you know, I'm not strictly archery. I hunt with a rifle. I shoot birds with a shotgun. I've tried to shoot them with a bow. That didn't ever turn out very well for me. though it was fun. So like I said, as long as it's a legal means and it provides an ethical harvest, I think a guy should use it to his advantage.
Agreed. And that's the key right there. The ethical harvest part. I would rather see someone use if they're not going to put the time in to practice with a compound bow and make sure they're confident, make sure they can hold that bow at draw, that they're steady. I would rather have them use a crossbow personally, because I feel like if they treat it the same, they're going to have a more ethical harvest.
Yes. And I have some guys that come out and hunt with me pretty regularly that, Kurt carries the crossbow and I carry his tripod. His son-in-law, he shoots a compound bow extremely well, extremely well. He actually shot on his college team when he went through school. So, you know, to see both aspects of it. Both of them are very ethical about their shots, and both of them, you know, both of them are pretty successful when they come out. And it is about practice. And Kurt does, he does shoot his crossbow pretty regularly just to make sure everything's still in tune and able to get the job done.
And I'm not saying you don't need trigger time on a crossbow. You still need to practice. But I mean that is definitely still key with anything, even with a rifle. If you're going to go out and rifle hunt, like, you should at least still practice somewhat and, like, make sure to continue to tune your craft.
Yes, and it allows you for an opportunity to inspect your equipment as well. We had three different failures with crossbows this year. Wow. A limb split on one, and then two cables broke. And what it boiled down to, the limb splitting, I'm not sure what the deal was. It was all the same brand crossbow, but I'm not going to say which brand.
Sure. Nope. And then I wouldn't either.
Yeah. The cable splitting had nothing to do with the crossbow itself. It was, you know, lack of upkeep on that, you know, not changing the string every couple years or every however many hundred shots through it. So that's what that boiled down to. So inspecting that equipment prior to, just the same as you should with your crossbow or your longbow, it making sure everything's right before you take it to field is going to be a big plus for you.
Absolutely. It absolutely is. And I'm very picky when it comes to my gear. You can ask anybody that's ever hunted with me. Like, if I'm out and it's wet, like even waterfowl hunting, like, I'll get back, and if my boat's trashed, I'll set everything up to dry. Before, even if I'm going out hunting the very next day, I will get everything as dry as possible. Like, I don't like mold. I don't want things to mold. I don't want things to rot. I don't want mildew. And I treat all my equipment that way. Like, all my rifles, if they get wet in the field, they're getting cleaned that night. Even if I'm going out back out the next morning and it's supposed to rain, I'm still probably going to clean it that night, just because that's how I am. Like, I don't want dirty equipment.
Well, and especially where you guys are at, rust is a real deal where you're at. We're quite a bit drier here. So if we get rain, it, first of all, it's a rarity. Second, everything's dried up so quick that you know, it may not be as big a deal. But when I get back in from hunting, I'm usually running oil over everything and making sure that I'm not going to have any rust issues.
Yeah, it's something I've had everything during our gun deer season. I've had rain, sleet, snow, hail, pretty much everything you can possibly think of. Freezing rain, that was a fun year.
I don't know that I've had freezing rain too much, but we've had just about every condition you can muster up. And during the fall here, we get some pretty good, you know, afternoon rain showers. If it's hunting season, we're going to go. It doesn't matter what the weather is doing.
Right. Got to have that quality gear. The freezing rains, like, threw me for a loop, because the drive in was fine. Walking back to the woods was fine. And I put one foot on my climbing tree stand and it slipped right off and my knee hit this tree and hit the base. I'm like, huh, that's icy. And I know I talked about that on another show for, like, hunting mishaps that we did. But it's like, I will never use those quick stirrup ones again. Like, there will always, like, they basically, your feet just slid under two pieces of plastic. Like, and there was nothing to hold, like, the back, like your Achilles, to make sure your feet didn't slide out. Like, never again. I will use straps that go behind my feet. That way there, when I'm locked in, my feet can't slide out.
Oh yeah. I don't blame you. I don't know that I've spent quite enough time in a tree stand, other than I did fall asleep and about checked my safety harness one time. But I've never slid out, you know, climbing up one.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't high. I had just basically put my foot in there, and I attached my safety harness when I'm still on the ground. So, like, I was perfectly safe, but I'm sure I scared every deer within a half a mile with my knee banging off that aluminum as hard as it did. I mean, it was loud enough that I had a buddy, like, I don't think we were within shouting. We were probably in shouting range, but he texted me and goes, "What was that?"
Yeah, you might have to put some sandpaper on them or something.
Yeah, I'm like, that was my knee. That hurt.
Oh, wow.
That was a good one. That was the same year when I went up there the first day. Like, we got up in the tree. Everything was super still. No wind. Dark. I don't remember what. It must have been cloudy because normally right now we're in a full moon and our gun season starts in 2 weeks. So no way it'd be a new moon. But it was dark, real dark. And you just heard all the wolves around us. And I'm like, this is almost eerie at this point. Because this was before we had a lot of wolves. This was years ago. And it's like, this is eerie. Being out here pitch black and you can hear the wolves and they're close enough, like where the neck, where the hair is standing up on your neck.
Oh yeah. The very first time that I heard wolves, for sure wolves, it got my attention for sure. And especially in our country, because there's still not a whole lot of them down there. We went up 4 or 5 years ago. I went up with a guy that I work with to Jackson for the opener for shed season. And we rode horseback into this spot, and just as the sun was coming up, they cut out up there. And you know, I was riding a 4-year-old. He was a pretty young horse, and he got a little antsy over that as well. So I wasn't the only one.
It's something. I wouldn't say I'm used to them now, but where we hold our grouse camp, like not this past, like the past few years where I've gone grouse hunting, it's either grouse camp or I've gone up for a while. At least one night you fall asleep to them howling. And it's to the point now, like if I'm in the camper or we're in the tent, like the dog isn't even that concerned anymore. She just kind of picks her head up and she looks around. She goes, whatever, and goes back to bed, which is kind of crazy to think about because it wasn't that long ago that I'd be like, wait, wolves? Like I'm in a tent? Like this is stupid.
Well, how do you mitigate the wolves in your dog?
So the hound hunters have far more issues than bird hunters do.
You bet.
And I know some of the hound hunters that I know, as soon as they opened wolf season, their bear camp was fired back up and they went hard on that pack that was messing up their dogs, and that pack pretty much was gone.
That season was heard far and wide. And I don't, you know, without getting too much into it, it sounds like there was a very, very, very healthy population of wolves, and is still.
There is still a very healthy population of wolves. And what blows my mind about that, and eventually I'm going to have to bring on one of those guys if they're willing to actually talk about it, because I know it's such a controversial topic to a degree. I mean, amongst most my listeners, it's fine. It's when this gets out to not my listeners, right? And then if people go crazy, they lose their minds. But I want to know, like, you've got towns that are trained on bear. They train them on bear. And I know some of them also train them on coyote, but like, how did they get them to flip that switch to run a wolf track? Like that's like, they don't train for it. I know they weren't training for it. Like, how did they get the dogs to do it? Like that blows my mind from a dog training aspect.
Yeah. You know, I've got a, when you're talking about dogs and their noses and what they can smell and how they can dictate from one thing to the next is pretty crazy. I would imagine the jump from a coyote to a wolf wouldn't be too far extreme, but they've got to know the difference.
Right.
So I'd be interested to hear that too. We had a pair that worked all winter last winter in a spot that I like to lion hunt. And I was far more careful about turning the dogs out in certain spots. And even though it was a pair and I'm running 6 and 7 or 8 hounds at a time, I hate to have one of them be killed because of my stupidity. So
agreed.
trying to make sure that I'm able to make it to the catch before, you know, before they can get hurt is big.
So it's a little different from the bird hunting side. I don't know exactly what our hound hunters do really to mitigate it, if they can really do anything, to be honest. But my dog runs pretty close. If she's pushing 60 to 80 yards in the grouse woods, that's pretty far. Like at that point, she's starting to come back and check in. I don't have a dog that runs 200 to 300 yards out there. So
okay.
I think that's a big, I mean, we have ran into wolves. I've seen 2 now while I've been out hunting. Both times they've turned around and went away, and my dog wanted nothing to do with it. My dog wasn't like interested, curious. She didn't, she didn't run away, but she wasn't like, she's like, I want nothing. It wasn't like, I want to go play either. But you know what I mean? Like, so both times I've ever had any experience with that, like they've taken off. Now this past year, I took up a dog trainer out of Illinois for his first trip grouse hunting. And we came into an area and it was like a light switch flipped and my dog was between my legs. I'm like, what? Like, she was scared. I have no idea what it was. We never figured it out. But like, I'm like, all right. So we worked back around and like we avoided that area. But the way we came back through was on the edge of a marsh and we had to kind of come past that area again. And right when we got to that same area, she was terrified again. So I don't know if there was a wolf den in there. I mean, she's bumped bear before. I mean, she's flushed black bears out of berry bushes and they just take off running. They want nothing to do with her. And my dog doesn't chase them. And she's like, huh, what was that big furry thing? Like, and then she goes back to bird hunting. So the only thing I can think of is there was a wolf den or something was going on there. And she was scared.
Huh, that's interesting. I've got a German wire hair pointer that I use for finding sheds.
Okay.
And I've always concerned with him because he thinks that he's the toughest thing that's walked the earth. And even with coyotes, he shows no deterrence, no anything. He's right in their face and letting them know that they better get out of there. So I worry with a bigger one that he may not back down. And it's, you know, it's always concerning. And unfortunately, they're going to become more prevalent because they'll come north out of Colorado. In fact, they are coming north out of Colorado now. And, you know, it's just something we're going to have to learn to deal with.
It definitely does change things. There's no doubt about that. It changes the it changes how the animals react. It changes everything about the ecosystem.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And it's, you know,
right,
like I said,
right or wrong, I don't know. Like, I don't know right or wrong, right? I mean, there could be argument, like we wiped them off for the reason. They were here for a reason. I don't even want to get into that argument. The fact is, though, that they definitely change the ecosystem when they come to a new area.
And that's correct. Right, wrong, or indifferent. It's something that that all of us as hunters, you know, from the Midwest on are going to have to get used to and, you know, have to adapt to.
And that's exactly it. Should their population be in some sort of check and control? I think so. We control all the other populations that there is. I don't see why we wouldn't have, if we have the numbers to support a hunt, I'm 100% for a hunt. I'm for population control. I'm for control of all of that. I mean, we impose on wildlife habitat every single day. The more we spread out in subdivisions, like, I mean, it's not like we're not having an impact on nature, no matter what we do.
And that's right. We're, you know, the human population is constantly growing, and we're constantly moving into animals' territory, into where they want to be. So we're going to have to deal with them, and it doesn't matter whether it's wolves or deer or turkeys. They're going to be there.
That's exactly right. Or out by you, lions.
Well, and from what I hear and some of the pictures that I get, out by you, some lions.
I mean, not a lot. There's enough, though. There's enough that it makes you, it's always kind of in the back of your mind, like, I could be stalked. Like, lions freak me out way more than wolves do. I'll be honest.
I'm telling you, I sleep great at night in the woods. When it comes to lions and black bears, I'm fantastic. It's the bigger bears that make me a little more nervous.
Black bears don't bother me. I mean, I've ran into them before. They run away. I mean, I've never ran one in like the springtime with cubs. Different scenario. But when I'm out in the woods, they don't want anything to do with me. Basically, I don't want anything to do with them. It's a perfect situation.
You bet. I was up. During elk camp this year, a buddy of mine shot his elk, and we got him all packed down to camp. And there's been a pretty good string of heads and antlers coming up missing from people's camps. So I took the head and I put it behind my tent where you couldn't see it, you know, very easily unless you came right into camp. And I don't know, it was about 11 o'clock. I hear something chewing on the head right next to my tent. And you know, I'm in my sleeping bag and I counted, I've got four zippers and my rifle's laying outside. I've got four zippers to get to my rifle. And if it's a sow and cubs, then it's not going to do me any good. So I just smacked the bottom of the tent and yelled at it. And then I heard it kind of grunting and I'm like, well, I'm pretty sure it's not a bear. It turned out it was a fox, and he made some pretty wild sounds back and forth with me for a while there. But yeah, I was a little embarrassed.
That's funny. Fighting with a fox.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, and he meant business.
He wanted his free meal. He wanted his scraps.
Yes. And by golly, he got some.
Well, Aaron, I appreciate you being on the show. I normally give these, I didn't prepare you at all for this. So I normally give the last couple minutes to my guests to shout out. If you want to talk, like say the name of your guide service, if you want to share any social media channels you have, I heard you say you video. So if you have a YouTube channel or anything like that, if you want to let the listener know how they can find you, and then I'll also post any links you might want as well in the description.
Oh yeah. So, I guide for Tyler Sims Outfitters. It's as far as what I've seen, it's a class act. Even, you know, going and hunting with another outfitter someplace else, he really holds a high standard at his place, and we tend to have a lot of fun in the fall. I don't have YouTube, but my Instagram is chasing307tail. It's all one word, and the 307 is the numbers. Yeah, you can check out, it's not just lion hunting on there, but it's a lot of lion hunting, a lot of the hounds. Some of the stuff that I do on the side, starting colts, is on there, riding horses and going to brandings and just enjoying the outside as much as I can. And yeah, as far as the elk hunting and stuff, if you have any questions, you know, about the preference point system and any of that, definitely, you know, reach out to me. And if I don't know, I'm sure I know somebody that does.
Awesome. I will definitely get the links to all that in the description, so everyone listening can find it easily. Makes life easy. You can just click.
Excellent. Well, thank you for having me on it. This was a lot less nerve wracking than what I thought it was going to be.
Like once we got once the Wi-Fi caught up and we were like good and able to like, not like have weird glitching, like it really went well.
Yes. And hopefully I didn't sound like a complete idiot, because, you know, that could happen.
No, it was good. It was a good time. I appreciate it. I learned a lot. Like I've never had someone on the show from Wyoming. So it was great to hear about like the diversity and the different terrain you're hunting and like the opportunities for wildlife and kind of how you do things out there.
Oh, you bet. When John reached out, I kind of hesitated for half a minute and I thought, heck, why not?
Well, Aaron, I really appreciate you coming on. All my listeners, again, thanks again for tuning in. And until next time, everyone, keep chasing that experience.
Thanks for tuning in to another killer episode here on Paddle and Fin. Be sure to drop a 5-star rating, a thumbs up, or smash that subscribe button on any platform you're listening in on. Be sure to check us out on Waypoint TV, waypointtv.com. Make sure you sign up for the Fantasy Kayak Fishing League at paddleandfin.com/fantasy. You could support this show through Patreon, patreon.com/paddleandfin. Don't forget to check out the website, paddleandfin.com. Catch us on YouTube. If you got a question, comment, or want to see a future guest on the show, be sure to email us at paddleandfin@gmail.com. Shout out to our show supporters, Yak Gadget. You can check out all the fine kayak accessories at yakgadget.com. Pelican Professional. For all your cases, coolers, and lighting needs, go to pelican.com. Rocktown Adventures, your Midwest premier paddle sports destination, go to rocktownadventures.com. Eastport Marina, the beautiful destination on Dale Hollow Lake. If you're looking for lodging, kayaks, kayak accessories, or anything fishing related on the beautiful Dale Hollow Lake, go to eastport.info. And Jigmasters Jigs. When in doubt, get the jig out. Go to jigmasters.com and fill your tackle boxes today.
One of the most legendary shows in the outdoors is on Waypoint TV. Don't miss Primo's Truth About Hunting, Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.
Every once in a while, it's fun to go like just full-blown redneck on these fish. This is like high-tech cane pole fishing right here.
From the white sandy beaches to the crystal blue waters, enjoy the best fishing Panama City Beach has to offer during Chasing the Sun. Sundays at 9:30 a.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.